I wanted to say something also in starting the talk about how to participate in a talk. And the primary criteria is to just be awake. And we get into, when we're at a talk, thinking or imagining or recalling or thinking of what we think about is being said, and that leads to sort of drifting away. What we try to do is to return to the let whatever the thoughts and reflections of them go, and return to the subject of the talk. Just try to come back. And for a lot of us, that means we're doing nothing but coming back, because we're doing nothing but drifting off. So that's my one thought on that. Going back to the precept, and what Jhana mentioned, do no harm, is one of my pure precepts. The other two are to cultivate what is good and wholesome. The third is to understand heart and mind. And the usual three pure precepts are embrace and sustain all good, embrace and sustain all beings, embrace and sustain right conduct. So it's a little bit different, and it's sort of the path of understanding instead of completely being it. And for that reason, I think I've been trying to understand for about 45 years with Jikoji and its precedents, been working at that. And Jikoji, of course, is like Buddhism. It's based on the precepts and based on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. But basically, it comes down to understanding, I think. But also, there's a lot of tradition in Jikoji, so there are many, many customs, like this stick and the robes we wear, the chants. I have one thing that I... This is way off to the side, but sort of like a pure precept, and it's a poem by a monk called Ryokan, who lived, I think, at the end of the 20th century. And he was a homeless, propertyless, wandering monk. Probably the most beloved person in Japan, most beloved poet. Now, he says, since leaving the household, my whereabouts depend on cloud and mist, one moment mingling with woodcutters and fishermen, next moment flocking with children. How could I be satisfied by the glory of kings and lords? To be a sorcerer is not my wish. Wherever I visit, I stay. It does not have to be Bodhidharma's Mount Song. Renewing my practice day by day, I resolve to reach complete serenity. So I'll take that as Ryokan's answer as to his great precept. I have some other examples of one great precept. Just to see things as they are. And this sort of was used as an introduction to a book describing or characterizing Buddhas. So the conclusion is sort of that we're all interdependent, we're all in this together, we're in this soup. Love and compassion is a favorite, I think, in Western culture, of a great precept. Also part of Buddhism. Continuous practice is another way of saying love or compassion or seeing things as they are, vastness, emptiness, nothing holy, neither holy nor unholy, and so on. Well, all that's by way of preamble. My great precept has always been truth. And I argued that in a discussion series that we had in Science and Buddhism. Truth is really the science, the core of mathematics particularly. Every time you see an equation, it's a statement of truth, aspect of truth. It's also science. What they're looking for is the truth. We haven't found it yet, but we're getting closer. Quantum physics, for one thing, is probably science's closest approximation to what really is the core. There's another way of saying the precepts, which is as aspects of truth. Now, the precepts themselves are just no killing, no stealing, no lying, no misuse of sex, no intoxication, so on, 10 of them. But, for example, not to kill is everlasting aspect or facet of truth. You can't kill truth. Not to steal is the ungraspable aspect of truth. Not to misuse sex or attach is free truth. It's free. Not to lie, inexplicable. I would even say truth is ineffable. Every one of us sort of believes in truth of equality and truth of society, truth of justice pervades society in our machinations toward working toward something that's a just society. Intoxication, not to be intoxicated, not to intoxicate yourself or others. Pure truth. Not to blame or dwell on past mistakes. Faultless truth. Not elevating or denigrating, not praising or blaming. Truth of equality. No hoarding, no greed, pervading truth. It's all around us and within us. No anger, no hatred, no wishing harm to another. Truth of no self. We're in it together. The three treasures, not abusing the three treasures. I don't know that all of you know, but it's basically the truth of oneness. Everything's the same. So, that is what we're studying for the next 6 weeks. And it is ineffable. It's also ingraspable. So you throw out words and different perspectives and different aspects of it. But you can't catch it. A philosopher that I loved, Krishnamurti, great teacher, not of Zen or Buddhism, but teacher of belief in freedom and equality and our potential, used to say that he and a friend were walking and they saw truth and recognized it. And the friend looked at him and said, "Let's organize it." It's not possible. So to shift gears a little bit and hopefully to lighten up a little bit, because I think I'm being too heavy.
Is the realm of what is real but not true.
And in that, I put the real realm of human delusions, of what we think, and our ideas mostly. They're not really real in the sense of, or they're not really true in the sense of necessarily panning out or having a relation to what is real. But they are real. And there's a lot of suffering that goes along with them. And the suffering is due to mostly separation, separating ourselves from what is true, separating ourselves from others. The illusion of separation is suffering. It's also sometimes called misalignment, where you have your ideas are not quite the same as what's actually happening. So you have this egocentric view of the world, kind of a local self, and there's also the world itself that's moving along nicely and that you have to rejoin eventually. Just as a note, I noticed in the New York Times yesterday an article on quantum physics and the basis for quantum physics, and the thesis of the article was that there really isn't any reality that quantum physics, quantum mechanics, is able to identify. That you get down a certain level. I think it's actually 10 to the 50th orders of magnitude below our scale. And by comparison, the edge of the universe is 10 to the 30th times above our scale. So we're maybe above the middle a little bit, and maybe that virus are in the middle of what is real, or that scale, at least. But the point of the article, that there's no agreement. The wave particle dilemma is one, or dichotomy is one. Sometimes things behave like waves, sometimes they behave like quantum particles. And how they behave is a function of how you test and observe them. Maybe it's what you want to see. So going back to ego and the illusion of separateness, there was a talk by a psychologist that you can find, TED Talk, I just happened to notice this week also. And it was on mental health. And his thesis was that we are incredibly attentive to our bodily needs. You know, we patch a cut or a bruise immediately, but that we don't patch mental problems. Key one that he identified and talked about in his talk, which was totally secular, it had nothing to do with religion, but it was the loneliness. And he cited studies that proved that loneliness themselves, just feeling alone, I do most of the time, and separate, is a good way to kill yourself. It's about right up there with smoking as far as the statistics on how long you're going to live is concerned if you suffer from chronic feelings of isolation. But that itself is a very grave threat. He also talked about problems like I didn't write them down, unfortunately. Being injured psychologically, mentally, problems. Being rejected, or feeling like a failure. And these, he say, are very, very common. I know when, particularly I think going back to Coben and his reference to this one great precept, and then his feelings of kind of withdrawing, messing up, fearing of messing up. That in contrast to what is, in contrast to this reality, and particularly in our culture, in Western culture, we try to be ideal. We try to be blameless and try to be faultless and try to rise and try to get ahead, try to attain something. And that leads to ego stimulating thoughts of self. You know, I will be this, I am this, I try to imagine myself. And the ego strengthens, reinforces, and lays on layer after layer after layer of self-understanding that's kind of false. There's another book called Open Heart, Open Mind that I'll leave on the coffee table that identifies some of the key layers. And he talks about a mirror self being what the child comes into when he's born. And then after that, as you begin to have some sense of separation, the solid self. I'm solid, everything else is solid. I move around in relation to the solid. Then he talks about the precious self, and that's sort of maybe characteristic of becoming a teenager, where you suddenly value yourself. You put a price on yourself relative to others, and maybe others are above you and others are below you, and these kinds of kids are the ones you want to play with, and these you won't touch, and these you can't aspire to being with.
Griffiths, the first one you mentioned, the mirror self?
The mirror self.
Is that like the self when a child develops?
Yeah.
They kind of mirror their world, or their...
Yeah.
They're informed by...
Yeah.
They're absorbing the world or something.
Yeah. Oh. Sort of like just being in the flow of whatever is and being aware of that, but not... no conscious idea of how you're going to react to it, or no preparation. All of these are sort of like that. There were two more layers, which also I didn't write down, but you can look at the book. After the precious self becomes the social self, when you go beyond sort of the valuing of people and yourself and trying to be better than you are and so on. And the social self is the guy who's, you know, good at manipulating and taking care of situations and so on. Then there becomes the useful self, where you may be, for example, taking care of a monastery or taking care of a group, research group, or clients, so on. And you find value in yourself in that sense. But all of them are sort of illusory. They're not harmful. They're necessary almost, and you might want to pick your ego depending on the situation and the challenges. But they're not quite in concert with the ideas, are not quite in concert with maybe the physical situation around you. So it's not, the idea is not to extinguish ego, not to extinguish the self. Now even, I happened to see another TED talk that I'll mention that was on sex and eroticism. And the idea in that talk was not to extinguish our feelings of eroticism, but this was in the context of long-term relationships. But instead to relate to them in a healthy fashion. Try to take care of ourselves. Go back to the psychological need to take care of yourself emotionally as well as physically. That aspect. The Open Heart, Open Mind book, basic conclusion is to live comfortably. You can't rise above your situation and you need some rest and relief. But also with open heart and open mind. And his core, I think, precept was that at the core of each of us, or maybe the one precept from his viewpoint, was that we're born with this spark of aliveness and awareness. And is of something within ourselves also that he called essence love. Other teachers, Buddhist teachers, have talked about it as empty cognizance or knowing, but knowing not necessarily attaching to what you're knowing, just being aware. And the problem in all this,
again, is selfishness. And we get into that again and again, that we react to a situation in terms of our own desires, immediate desires, and not so much from the understanding that we're all in it together, that it's all part of one whole, growing and evolving and changing. So Zazen, the key thing that I've been trying to understand for 45 years is how Zazen relates to this. You wouldn't think that Zazen is a cure for emotional problems. And maybe it's not, but still, it has a lot to offer. And Zazen, in part, one aspect of it is that we do see what our mind grows through a lot, what our habitual patterns of thinking are, discursive thoughts and affective emotions, sometimes the affective emotions underneath those thoughts. Like when you're rejected, it's quite natural to, you know, feel badly. But the one native reaction to that is not to try to come out of it, but instead just to reinforce it, depreciating, demeaning, disparaging yourself in terms of how you deserved all that. And failure also. You see yourself fail, the norm may be just to give up. And that's not so healthy. So going back to Koban and his great precept, he said, relative to Zazen, I think in general, he said, nothing belongs to me, not even my body. So in Zazen, you see things, you see emptiness and form, your spine and your shoulders that might not be held right, and your posture, your thinking. But none of that really belongs to you. It comes, thoughts happen, and if you're lucky, you just let them go, or if you're aware of them. Same with feelings in Zazen. Just to let it go, come back, return, be awake, be present. Koban also said one must disappear in the sitting. And my guess as to what he meant, he said one must disappear in the sitting, it is the only way. My guess is that what disappears is the ego consciousness that's trying to make something out of the situation or else indulging itself. Another perspective is when we sit, we are nothing. We do not even realize what we are. So sitting Zazen, don't get anything. You're not into it so much as you're nothing. Things are happening, thoughts are coming and going, emotions, feelings, sensations, senses, waves, tides, currents, storms of thoughts and feelings. But I myself am hopefully nothing. I'm just awake. Yeah. Any discussion or questions or comments?
I have one question. Early in your talk, you used the term local self, a local self, which is kind of curious about that term. What a local self is. So I started to think about what's a non-local self? Or is there such a thing as a local a self that's not local? So I'm wondering if you thought about that term, or if anyone has any thoughts about what a non-local self self the next county.
Yeah, I have sort of a strong energetic stuff that I would push out, but if anybody else has any good answer to that.
Cliff, I want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah.
I want to hear what your energetic push is.
Just this. Is the global self.
Just this. Yeah. Just this is it.
This present presence, and I go on that. I really love the idea of this present presence. In terms of mindfulness, I start my practice with a kind of a dedication to actually Jikoji and teachers and so on, but mostly this present presence, whatever is there. And in terms of mindfulness, I'm hoping to be mindful, I'm trying to be mindful, but I'm also inviting this present presence to penetrate, permeate, and pervade. And that there's a teaching from Tibetan, actually Milarepa, that says, don't view as separate the forms and emptiness. So maybe this present presence is a kind of emptiness that penetrates, pervades, and permeates consciousness. And the awakeness becomes maybe not a local self, but there's emptiness and other things.
And a big, big mind sometimes.
Yeah. John?
I like what Corbin calls it boundlessness rather than emptiness. You know, there's me out there, I'm green and I'm sitting on a tree waving in the wind, and I'm over there in the pond. And so it's more everything rather than nothing.
Yes.
So that would be my idea of where we are, is everywhere.
Yeah. I love boundlessness also, but I'm not sure that Coben used it.
Or was that taking that Hans Neutron's
translation? No, that was Kaz's translation.
Kaz's, wrong name.
Instead of for shunyata, instead of emptiness, which oftentimes is received negatively, like something's missing or lacking, he used the term boundless, which is spatial, so it sets up a whole different dynamic. But it's very interesting, isn't it?
I wondered if you'd ever read that book called The Masks of the Universe, if you're interested in, you know.
I'm interested, I haven't.
Finding the definition. I've carried it around since I was 28, and it talks about, you were saying quantum physics is getting close to the truth.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe there's any way for us to know the truth. And I like that it's a great mystery. And I've got the book, I can lend it to you.
Yeah.
And basically it's an overview of what we've believed as human beings from when we came out the cave and tripped over a rock and went, damn you tripped me up, you know, to how many angels on the head of a pin and how the mechanistic universe. And then he goes into quantum. And he said all of these are like making a mask to put on the face, you know, to make it recognizable. But the face is so whatever we think of as the truth just misses it.
Mm-hmm.
It's only a way to try and look at it. Mm-hmm. It drove me crazy for years trying to, what is it, you know, what's the truth, what's the answer. But when I read that book, I just thought, yeah, I like that great mystery. It doesn't have to be, because whatever I'm seeing, that's not the truth. Do you think it's possible to find a truth?
Possible to what?
To find a truth, to find the truth or a truth.
I just went right through it, I think.
The truth is one of many ancient ideals coming from Greek and Socrates and Plato, and other ideals are beauty and love, and reality might be another one, but there's no question. But there, I once made up a poem that good transcends, beauty reigns, truth trumps. Truth is what's going to trump us. Marco?
It's interesting saying that the quantum physics, lately the last papers that they publish, like even science or so on, the last few years, they talk about non-local realism experiments, where they say that normally there is a local reality, and quantum physics try to understand what's a non-local reality. And the take-home message is that all the options are real. You know, it's this amazing concept of quantum physics that depending on the experiment, you might impose one reality versus the other, so it collapses into a local reality. But around that, there is a non-local reality, which is all the options, and which, interestingly, as a practical term, is leading to experiments that are making possible, like teleportation and time travel to a quantum level, so to a small quantum particles, and now they were able to do as more molecules. So it's a matter of energy, potentially you could. But that, because it is saying you have to believe that what you believe is not true. And that makes you understand it in a local reality. So everything is possible. So because a place and a truth is not real, it can be all of that. So you can choose which one you want to make another one, which is impressive, and that's what quantum physics is saying. Instead of just give up on what you believe, so you can make it impossible, which is very fascinating.
This whole topic on truth is very interesting to me. Perhaps it's something that I need to...
Thank you. I do have problems in hearing, so...
I have problems with mumbling.
Me too.
So, truth. I've been thinking about this whole topic on truth the whole week, mainly because I've been talking to a friend who's been suffering for many reasons, and it goes usually like, I wish I had this, I don't like this, I feel depressed, I feel like I'm stuck, and when she said it, she feels like she's stuck, it kind of connected to me, to kind of care about what she's saying, because that feeling of feeling stuck feels kind of familiar to me as well. Now, I'm trying to, you know, she's not a 10th student, she says she understands the concept of it, but this is not my perception, this is the truth of what I'm thinking. When somebody is so sure that this is not my perception, this is the truth, what could I do to break that and penetrate through to her mind?
That's a question in the area of skillful means, and I'm looking around for a psychologist. Psychiatrist, excuse me. Could you?
So you're trying to do what? I'm sorry, trying to...
When somebody is so convinced that what they have in their mind is the truth and not perception, and thus struggling, what is the action that it takes to help her?
The approach I would take is to join in her perception and see what you see from that vantage point.
I see.
And just the fact that you join in and see the same view from the side to side, mm-hmm. she feels relieved that, oh, I'm not just by myself.
No separation.
And then there's a window for you to take, or maybe you want to go see from this vantage point. And then she's willing, maybe, because she knows you're willing to go to her place first. And then there's a window, the heart-to-heart connection of, instead of you trying to fix her or...
I just want her to...
I know, it's coming from a very good place, but she doesn't see it. She doesn't, you know,
right.
Because she's invested in this perception, right?
Yes.
Yeah. There's a reason that
you and I
don't know exactly why that place is so absolute for her. So you might want to find that out.
I'll pull that one.
Okay.
Thank you.
I don't know.
Sorry. What?
A number of questions. It reminds me of this. There's this idea of asking not what is truth, but what is the value of truth? Why do we even want it? What purpose does it serve? And if we can't actually find some absolute truth, if all truths are just relative and from a different perspective, well, then we can shift them. You know, I don't know how you do it quantum physics wise, but we can shift them to reflect our values. So, like, you could ask your friend at some point, I think this is better than this question, but, you know, what is the value of you hanging on to this version of your truth? Do you really know? And what purpose is it serving? I one of my fundamental values is to appreciate life, you know, and do life enhancing and life affirming activity. So truths that don't jive with that, why do I need to accept them? We don't have any like strict calculus that, you know, forces one to believe this or that theory. Anyway.
Thank you. I wanted to read something from Dogen, actually from the Genjo Koan, and it is just a particular paragraph from the Genjo Koan. It's a very, very famous koan. But he says, when one first seeks the truth, one separates oneself from its environs. When one has already correctly transmitted the truth to oneself, one is one's original self at that moment.
Could you read it again, please?
When one first seeks the truth, one separates oneself from its environs. When one has already correctly transmitted the truth to oneself, one is one's original self at that moment. But then you need to return.
I feel like there's something that came up for me and that ties into what you're saying, which is Khalil Gibran had a passage that was really beautiful, and he's saying, you know, people of Sophocles, the people he's speaking to, that you are the beauty and you are the mirror reflecting the beauty. You are eternity and you are the veil obscuring that.
Yeah.
And the beauty, the eternity, the truth, those are the same. So we're both the only observer seeing that, but also because of our beliefs, we are the one who obscures it.
Yeah.
moment to moment to moment. So the paradox is that we're both the mirror and the veil, and it's all there at the same time.
To extend that a little bit, in Zazen, it is indeed to get beyond the ego. All you get out of Zazen maybe is yourself. You turn to your true self, your original self. And then you have to return again because you've forgotten it immediately thereafter, frequently. Maybe. Todd?
I don't know if it's the definition of the rose-colored glasses, but there was a talk at Canando, similar Dharma talk, and afterwards question and answers, and a man was, I forgot exactly what the subject was, but it resonates, and I think about it a lot. He was talking about looking at the wall, and unlike these walls where they're smooth, they have a texture, anthropomorphic forms, and he found that it was a parallel to what he found happens. So when he sits, he sees there's nothing. It's just these patterns and textures. But within a fairly short period of time, he starts to starts to see things. And he saw that maybe this is how it's the inherent inclination to try and put these forms into something that, quote unquote, is sensible.
Mm-hmm.
So then Les goes, well, yeah, it's very similar. It's like kind of that's what happens. You turn around, and then that's what we do. We put these things into some kind of semblance, mm-hmm. just inherently. So I don't know if that's is that the kind of rose-colored glass kind of thing? You see things through this particular way. It's just kind of inescapable on one hand. Mm-hmm. Perhaps slowing down and being quiet allows.
We've been known to describe the world
yeah.
to ourselves and others as well.
Knowing that, though, just that then it's an idea, really. Even that is an idea, right? So, does that help? Somehow?
After the line that when we sit, we are nothing, I think Suzuki Roshi goes on to say, but then when we get up, we recreate. Mm. And I think this is the recreation, essentially. We see each other, and we are ourselves and in relation to everybody else. As we return to our normal egocentric functioning.